Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The Associated Press reports that world major powers and Iran have agreed to extend nuclear talks until July 7th. The nuclear program talks were underway in Vienna Tuesday, with Tehran and the group of six world powers trying to reach a long-sought comprehensive nuclear agreement. The nuclear negotiations are taking place in Vienna, and the deadline for the deal was today. The Iranian foreign minister, Zarif, returned with his nuclear chief, Ali Akbar Salehi. They're meeting with the U.S. delegation. The Secretary of State, Kerry, is meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. A 17-year-old boy has died from Ebola in Liberia. We have details now from VOA's Miriam Diballo.
Deputy Health Minister Talbert Nienswa, who heads Liberia's Ebola response, told VOA the teenager died on June 24th and was given a safe burial the next day. Our surveillance team is working very well. They've picked up this dead child from his parents' home, tested him yesterday, and the child was positive. He says it's not known yet how the boy contracted the disease, but the case is under investigation. He stressed the public should not panic, noting that it's the only known case since the country was declared Ebola-free by WHO officials on May 9. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar.
The UN Security Council has extended the peacekeeping mission in Sudan's Darfur region for another year. The extension was approved even though the Khartoum government had asked for the mission to be withdrawn. The $1.1 billion a year peacekeeping force is operated jointly by the African Union and the United Nations. VOA News. The Indonesian officials say at least 49 people were killed when a military transport plane crashed into a residential neighborhood on the island of Sumatra. The Hercules C-130 was trying to return to the airport after takeoff Tuesday when it slammed into a hotel and two houses in Medan, Indonesia's third largest city. Pictures from social media show the downed aircraft in flames with thick black smoke coming from the damaged buildings and destroyed vehicles. The death toll is expected to rise, as local media and officials have said as many as 113 people were on board the plane. A United Nations agency in the European Union mission in Thailand Tuesday called for the country's ruling junta to release 14 pro-democracy students arrested and charged with sedition. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports.
In a statement, the UN Human Rights Office, the OHCHR, for Southeast Asia, called for Thailand to promptly drop criminal charges against the students arrested June 26th for peacefully demonstrating in public the previous day at the Democracy Monument in Bangkok. The students face up to 7 years in prison for defying the junta's ban on public demonstrations and holding gatherings that oppose the government's rule. The OHCHR's statement notes Thailand, as a party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, has the obligation to uphold the right to freedom of expression and the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. The ruling junta has defended its laws banning political gatherings as necessary for maintaining peace. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Officials in Japan say one man on the nation's high-speed bullet trains set fire to himself Tuesday, killing himself and one other passenger. The national broadcaster NHK said the man and a female passenger were dead and the train car filled with smoke. The train was carrying about 1,000 passengers traveling to the Odawara station from the Shinkohama station. Some of the injured were escorted into ambulances, as we hear here, and several people were overcome by smoke. The exact number of injuries remain unconfirmed. The train remained stopped on the tracks outside of Odawara City for about 3 hours. The bullet train service in that area was suspended while the incident was investigated. Greek banks remained shut on Tuesday as the nation looks set to formally default on a $1.8 billion loan repayment to the International Monetary Fund. While the country's economic future remained uncertain early Tuesday, the Greek finance ministry said it would open about 1,000 bank branches across the country to allow pensioners to withdraw enough money to get through the week. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A 17-year-old boy has died from Ebola in Liberia just 7 weeks after the World Health Organization declared the country free of the deadly virus. Officials are trying to determine how the boy contracted the illness.
That's VOA's Mariama Diallo reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Egypt's president pledges swift justice for yesterday's assassination of the state's chief prosecutor. Burundi's ruling party says it is happy with the turnout in yesterday's parliamentary election, despite an opposition boycott and international criticism, while the UN Refugee Agency says thousands of Burundians continue to flee political instability and violence. We'll have these stories, plus sports, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Associated Press reports that Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi today has pledged swift justice for yesterday's assassination of the state's chief prosecutor. During the funeral for Hisham Barakat at Cairo's Tantawi Mosque, Mr. el-Sisi said swift justice is restricted by laws. The president said he will amend the laws to speed up legal proceedings so justice can be attained as soon as possible. Barakat was killed by a car bomb as he left for work. It was inside a parked car as the prosecutor's security convoy passed. Officials said the bomb was set off by remote control. There has been no claim of responsibility for the explosion. Barakat was the senior official overseeing prosecution of former President Mohamed Morsi and thousands of Islamists jailed in a security crackdown ordered last year by Mr. el-Sisi. A 17-year-old boy has died from Ebola in Liberia just 7 weeks after the World Health Organization declared the country free of the deadly virus. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports officials are trying to determine how the boy contracted the illness.
Deputy Health Minister Talbert Nienswa, who heads Liberia's Ebola response, told VOA the teenager died on June 24th and was given a safe burial the next day.
Our team was there yesterday,
he said, to investigate the situation and know the area. But to be vigilant is good. We were vigilant. Our surveillance team is working very well. They've picked up this dead child from his parents' home, tested him yesterday, and the child was positive. He says it's not known yet how the boy contracted the disease, but the case is under investigation. He stressed the public should not panic, noting that it's the only known case since the country was declared Ebola-free by WHO officials on May 9th.
Mangini County is responding and no need.
Margibi County, he says, is responding and no need to panic. People hearing me, please lower your blood pressure. We are on top of this. The Ministry of Health, this is something we know how to deal with. But that message appears to be landing on deaf ears of a traumatized public. A resident of the affected community, Gbatim Success Nia, says memories of the thousands who died haunt him. He says he saw firsthand the impact it had on the survivors, and it's very scary to think that the virus is back.
I'm very afraid, and you know how difficult it was for some of our citizens who were business entrepreneurs, travel to a lot of countries, how difficult it was for them. People got stigmatized.
Mother of four children, Comfort Freeman, feels the same.
We the people can take precaution, but for children, for that matter, you can't take precaution. So I'm feeling so down this morning. I know indeed in God we trust that he can do anything possible.
The virus has killed more than 11,100 people since the outbreak began in late December 2013, hitting Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Guinea declared a 3-week quarantine this month in a new effort to eradicate Ebola. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar.
Burundi's ruling party says it is happy with the turnout in yesterday's parliamentary election, despite an opposition boycott and international criticism. Pascal Nyamvenda, chairman of the ruling CNDD-FDD party, said Burundian voters defied the opposition's call for a boycott because they prefer democracy to a coup d'etat. Turnout was reported to be thin for Monday's elections, and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who had called for the elections to be postponed, expressed serious concerns about the vote. Election officials say voting went smoothly before polls closed in the evening, but residents say gunfire and at least one grenade explosion could be heard in the capital, Bujumbura, despite a heavy security presence. No injuries were reported. Nyabenda denied claims the election was marred by poor turnout. He said Burundians turned out in large numbers because they want democracy. To critics who said the election was not free or fair, he said election monitors from the United Nations and from Kenya were present. African Union Chief Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma expressed concern about what she called the serious political and security situation in Burundi. AU observers were not participating in Monday's elections. Meanwhile, the UN Refugee Agency says thousands of Burundians continue to flee political instability and violence. About 10,000 refugees crossed into neighboring countries over the weekend before the government closed the borders prior to parliamentary elections. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
It's now estimated that at least 144,000 refugees have fled Burundi since the beginning of April. That's when violence erupted after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. UNHCR spokeswoman Karen De Frill says most of those who fled over the weekend went to Tanzania and Rwanda. She says closing the border crossing Sunday did not stop the exodus.
Refugees are still leaving the country. They are using now informal border crossings. Basically, a path through the bush. They find their way into Rwanda and Tanzania and come then to our offices or our presence near the border to register themselves as refugees. And from there, we take them to the camp in the three countries, Tanzania, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
While 144,000 have been registered as refugees, many others have not. They've entered neighboring countries without being counted by aid agencies.
There are also people who are going on their own, especially people going to cities or bigger towns, and have their own resources and do not necessarily register as refugees. So we do think that the number might be higher.
More than 66,000 Burundian refugees are in Tanzania, well over 56,000 in Rwanda, about 11,500 in the DRC, more than 9,000 in Uganda, and just 400 in Zambia. The UNHCR spokesperson says some were mistreated on their journey.
There are different reports of harassment. People are also reporting that it's becoming more and more difficult for them to leave the country, not only because borders are closed, obviously, which makes things more difficult, but there are also roadblocks where militias and others are trying to take away their belongings. So people are actually trying to leave the country more or less secretly, taking as little luggage as they can and going through the bush.
In the beginning, most of the refugees were women and children. Now there's a growing number of men. De Frill says many may be joining their families already in camps.
We have been setting up camps, or we have been moving people to existing refugee camps in most of the countries, with the exception of Zambia at the moment, because the numbers are very, very small.
Overcrowding is becoming a problem at the Nyarugusu camp in Tanzania. It was already home to 50,000 Congolese refugees. Now they're joined by 60,000 Burundians. An alternative site is being sought. The UNHCR is working with 17 other aid agencies to help the refugees, but funding is a problem. The agency has appealed for $207 million for the Burundi crisis, but has received only 13% of the amount so far. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you. The Italian Navy has begun efforts to recover the bodies of an estimated 800 migrants who drowned in the Mediterranean Sea in April. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi vowed to recover the bodies for the families of the victims. The fishing trawler sank off the coast of Libya in more than 1,200 feet of water when the boat's pilot made a miscalculation and rammed a cargo vessel. Shipwreck survivors estimated as many as 800 people were trapped below deck when the trawler sank. Only 28 migrants survived, and a few dozen bodies were recovered in the worst of several known shipwrecks of migrants this year. A record 70,000 migrants have made the crossing to Italy this year, with almost 2,000 dying at sea. Syrian and Eritreans are the largest populations making the dangerous voyage. Until recently, Italy and Greece were the major destinations for migrants. However, the European Union's top migration official says landlocked Hungary now equals Italy for migrant arrivals. In the first 6 months of this year, more than 66,000 migrants crossed Hungary's border with Serbia. Hungary is now planning to build a 13-foot-tall fence 110 miles of its border with Serbia. Yesterday, Hungarian police fired tear gas to subdue hundreds of residents of a crowded migrant camp, eastern city of Debrecen. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 17 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Egypt's president pledges swift justice for yesterday's assassination of the state's chief prosecutor. The corpse of a 17-year-old Liberian has tested positive for the Ebola virus. And Burundi's ruling party says it is happy with the turnout in yesterday's parliamentary election, despite an opposition boycott. And for more news and updates, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. The UN Refugee Agency says new figures show that the numbers of displaced Libyans has increased to at least 43,000, twice the number last September. The new figures amount to more than 83,000 families without homes and in need of aid and shelter. More than 100,000 of those internally displaced are in Benghazi in the east of Libya, where more than 60 schools have been closed, street clashes among militants are common, and landmines are a constant threat to civilians. The UN Security Council has extended the peacekeeping mission in Sudan's Darfur region for another year. This in spite of request by the government in Khartoum to withdraw the mission from the country. The $1.1 billion peacekeeper force is operated jointly by the AU and the UN. Peacekeepers entered the region in 2007 to restore law and order during a lengthy conflict between the Khartoum government and armed rebels. The UN currently estimates as many as 300,000 people have been killed. Some 4.4 million people need aid, and more than 2.5 million are displaced. Matthew Rycroft is Britain's ambassador to the UN. He says Sudan has the greatest number of internally displaced people in Africa, and last year saw the worst level of suffering in the last 10 years. The Council resolution describes Darfur security as deteriorating through a marked escalation of hostilities between government forces and rebel armed groups. Sudan's deputy UN ambassador Hassan Hamed Hassan says it is completely wrong to say Darfur is engulfed in war. Meanwhile, International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Bensouda has issued a plea for the UN Security Council to act to ensure justice in the Darfur conflict. Bensouda issued her appeal yesterday. She said it is long overdue for the Security Council to heed the cries of the victims of rape and sexual abuse, torture, mass displacement, and other inhumane suffering Darfurians continue to endure. The Hague-based court issued an arrest warrant for Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, who was accused of crimes including alleged genocide in the country's western Darfur province in March 2009. Bashir, who rejects the court's authority, has traveled within Africa and has not been arrested. Twenty minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, the DRC's government has launched a training program for former child combatants and victims of sexual violence. Nick Long reports on plans to help them find a better future.
Nearly 80 people crammed into a small village hall in Nyiragongo territory in eastern Congo on Friday to witness the signing of an agreement to help young victims and perpetrators of recent violence rebuild their lives. The two most important signatures on the document were those of the DRC president's personal representative in charge of the fight against sexual violence and the recruitment of children, Jeannine Mabunda, and of the administrator of Congo's National Institute for Professional Training, Maurice Chikuyi. Speaking through a translator, Chikuyi said he and his Institute for Professional Training colleagues came to the meeting from Kinshasa because they wanted the agreement to be witnessed by local people. Do you want me to sign this document? He asks, to a chorus of approval. Under the agreement, the government will pay the Institute for Professional Training $25,000 to give 2 months of skills training to 75 people, mostly young former combatants or victims of sexual violence. Officially, Jeannine Mabunda's office has a mandate to work for the reintegration of former child soldiers into civilian life. In a sense, that mission is largely accomplished, as the Congolese army demobilized its own underage fighters years ago. Mabunda told reporters that her office and the UN Children's Fund found there was not a single child soldier at any DRC army camp that they visited. There are still many underage combatants and former combatants from eastern Congo's armed groups, however, and sexual violence is still a major problem, although its scale should not be exaggerated, said Mabunda. She cited statistics indicating sexual violence cases reported in eastern DRC fell by 33% between 2013 and last year, from about 15,000 to about 10,000. The UN reports the Congolese security forces' involvement in sexual violence has fallen sharply. The 75 youngsters to be enrolled for training are likely just a first wave, Mabunda said.
C'est une première expérience. Elle commence à Nyiragongo. Elle va se poursuivre à Rutshuru, certainement.
This training for Nyiragongo is a pilot scheme, she says, and should be repeated in other territories of North Kivu and in other provinces. Thomas Ngumi Jimana is one of the ex-combatants who wants to enroll on a training course. He says most of them want training in agriculture, livestock rearing or carpentry because that is what most people do around here. Nkumi Chimana said that after some training he could make $150 with agriculture over 3 months. The young women said they hope to enroll on courses in dressmaking, pastry making and soap making. The Institute for Professional Training already has partnerships with the French Development Agency and other donors and is a trusted provider of training. The government's pledge to spend $25,000 on these training courses comes 2 days after the head of the United Nations mission in Congo, Martin Kobler, raised questions about the government's commitment to reintegrating former combatants. Kobler says the official program for reintegrating former combatants has not yet started, although the UN mission has allocated $6 million to a World Bank trust fund for the process. Donors have been reluctant to contribute to the fund because the government's contribution is not clear, he said. But he added the new DRC defense minister is very active in trying to launch the program. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Children's Fund reports millions of Iraqi children displaced by violence are in desperate straits. UNICEF says growing violence is putting children's lives at risk and stripping them of essential life-saving assistance. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 1 year has passed since the so-called Islamic State began a military offensive in northern Iraq. ushering in a period of widespread violence which continues. The United Nations reports more than 3 million people have been displaced since the start of 2014, most as a result of IS success in capturing Iraqi cities. UN humanitarian agencies estimate more than 8 million Iraqis are in need of life-saving assistance, a number that could reach 10 million by the end of the year. Acting UN Children's Fund representative in Iraq, Colm McInnes, calls the speed and scope of this crisis breathtaking. Speaking on a telephone line from Erbil, he says children are suffering most from the upheaval in their lives.
In 1 year's time, we've seen a 400% increase of the grave violations against children. These grave violations are the maiming of children, the abduction of children, it's the attacking of the basic services that these children otherwise would receive. For those children who are not in school, for those families who do not have services, the situation is getting much worse.
McInnes says the widespread violence and subsequent displacement of millions of people has resulted in the collapse of healthcare systems, the collapse of the country's educational system, and a collapse in the government's public safety net.
For children specifically, this is a desperate situation. This year's school year alone saw 650,000 children with no schooling whatsoever. Over 3 million children had their school year affected severely and did not attend a regular school cycle. For families, even access to basic items can be severe.
UNICEF representative McInnes notes nearly 3,000 people a week are fleeing Anbar province. He says these people require water, hygiene, basic shelter, and food. He warns their needs may not be met because UN agencies are suffering from a severe funding shortage. He says current water supplies will run out in about 3 weeks unless more money is received to replenish these stocks. He notes donors have provided only 20% of the $48 million needed for UN humanitarian operations until the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Egypt's president pledges swift justice for yesterday's assassination of the state's chief prosecutor. The corpse of a 17-year-old Liberian has tested positive for the Ebola virus. And Burundi's ruling party says it is happy with the turnout in yesterday's parliamentary election despite an opposition boycott. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for sports with Tati Abeje and Jonah Haskell, both sitting in today for Sonny Young, who's a little under the weather today. And welcome to you both.
Thank you, Kim.
So, Tati, it looks like Women's World Cup is topping your sports report
yes,
today.
Yes, it is.
Tell us all about it.
Today's the big game. The U.S. women's team will be facing the Germans in the semifinals in the Women's World Cup. Germany has the best offense, and the U.S. has the best defense in the tournament. So, Jonah, who do you believe is the X factor for the U.S.?
Well, Tati, I think probably the X factor for the U.S. in this game is going to end up being goalkeeper Hope Solo, mostly because, like you mentioned, the U.S. has the best defense in the tournament, but Germany has the best offense. And so as well as the U.S. defense can play, Germany is going to get chances. They're going to get shots. They have a great fluid offense. And so a lot of it is going to come down to Hope Solo's ability to stop those chances and stop those goals once they get past the defenders. And also, the U.S. offense hasn't looked great, so the U.S. is going to they're going to need all the help they can not allowing goals. If the U.S. ends up giving up two or three goals, I don't think they're going to be able to score that many, and I don't think they can win the game. So it's really going to come down to the performance by Hope Solo.
I believe the X factor is Carly Lloyd because she's most likely their number one goal-scoring threat for the team. And not only that, she has the freedom to get forward and reward Jill Ellis like she did in the last game against with Jill Ellis with the game-winning goal in the last game against China. But and against Germany, it's inevitable that she has to do a little bit more defending and provide her team with some goal scoring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it'll also be important for the U.S. that they're getting Megan Rapinoe and Lauren Holiday back. They missed the quarterfinal because they received two yellow cards earlier in the tournament. So, you know, those are two players who have a lot of presence in the U.S. midfield. And so it'll be nice to see them back on the field. I think that'll be a big boost for the U.S.
That will help. So what does the U.S. have to do in order to advance to the finals?
Well, what everyone's been talking about in the lead up to this game is how weak the U.S. offense has been and how great the defense has been. But of the U.S. defenders, three of them, Julie Johnson, Megan Klingenborg, and Becky Sauerbrunn, they've all played all 90 minutes of every game of the tournament on turf field. So you'd expect at this point their bodies might be starting to wear down. They're probably going to be tired. So I think it's going to be big for the U.S. to their midfielders, and this is what I was mentioning about Lauren Holiday and Megan Rapinoe. Their midfielders are going to have to hold the ball, you know, keep the ball in midfield, pass the ball around well, and sort of hold up the pace of play so that their back line, which is probably tired, is going to have time to recover from going forward and everything. I think that's going to be incredibly important. And then hopefully if the midfielders can, you know, work that out and make some good passes around midfield, then that'll transfer into sort of a more fluid attack with Alex Morgan and probably Amy Rodriguez going forward.
For me, it's for them to advance to the finals. Hope Solo has to play the game of her life, because she hasn't been all that busy since the openers against Australia. It was the last time that the U.S. has given up a goal. As you know, they have not given up a goal in the last 423 minutes. So she has to play at her best for them to win. So what is your prediction?
Well, you know, I'd love to say that I think the U.S. is going to win this game, but I don't really know how good their attack is going to be. I can see Abby Wambach coming off the bench late in the game and scoring an amazing game winner. I think that would be great, but Honestly, just going with my mind and everything that I know, I think this game will probably get to penalties, tied 1-1. And then, you know, the Germans, they won a penalty shootout against France. They've had experience with it. So I think probably the Germans will end up coming out on top in a penalty shootout.
I think that if the game is 1-0, the U.S. has a good chance of winning because of their defense. I think their defense can hold Germany's attack, and they will win 1-0 to advance to the finals. And time now for Africa News tonight's Africa Sports Report. Here's Mark Auma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Greetings to you, Mark.
South African Willem Coetzen amassed 8,341 points to place second in the decathlon at the IWF Combined Events Challenge in Ratingen, Germany on Sunday. He ranks second overall in the challenge standing with 16,789 points. Guilherme Thierry of Mauritius ranks eighth, while Florent Lombo of the Democratic Republic of Congo is 53rd. Meanwhile, Nigeria's Uhonoma Osazua tops the women's heptathlon ranking with 17,630 points, while Benin's Odile Ahuanawanu is ranked 40th. In Nigeria, Orupe Rayokan clocked 46.13 seconds as Adeloye Oluwatosin ran 52.48 seconds to win men's and women's 400 meters respectively at the Athletics Federation of Nigeria Golden League meeting in Kaduna City, Kaduna State in north central Nigeria on Saturday. Euphemia Edem prevailed in women's long jump with a leap of 6.48 meters as Divine Oduduru won the 200 meters in 20.80 seconds. Henry Okori won the men's 400 meter hurdles in 51.19 seconds as Glory Nathaniel prevailed in the women's event in 59.29 seconds. Hope Idey triumphed in women's triple jump with a leap of 13.40 meters as Okpara Tedas cleared the bar at 2.10 meters in men's high jump, and Kure Samuel won men's javelin with a throw of 70.21 meters. Moving on to basketball, Egypt edged Iran 62-59 as Canada outclassed Tunisia 93-36 at the Men's World Under-19 Basketball Championship in Heraklion, Greece on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Croatia overpowered Egypt 111-68 as Italy beat Tunisia 89-62. Today, Tuesday, Egypt challenged the United States of America as Tunisia faced Australia. In volleyball, Algeria dismissed Australia 25-19, 25-22, and 25-13 at the World Women's Volleyball Grand Prix in Tadi Korgan, Kazakhstan on Sunday. Meanwhile, Colombia beat African champions Kenya 25-21, 25-14, and 25-20 in Monterrey, Mexico. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. We now go to Jonah Haskell as he will give an update on Wimbledon.
Thanks, Toddy. The action continued today at the All England Club in London as the final matches of the first round of Wimbledon were played. Roger Federer secured his place in the second round as he defeated Damir Tsumer in straight sets 6-1, 6-3, 6-3. Federer, who has won the tournament a record seven times, lost to Novak Djokovic in the final last year. And another former Wimbledon champion, the great Rafael Nadal, was also on the court today, defeating Brazilian Tomas Bellucci 6-4, 6-3, 6-4. Nadal will be hoping to stay hot and win his first Wimbledon title since 2010, when he defeated Thomas Berdych in the final. And the only African competing in London, Kevin Anderson of Johannesburg, South Africa, played his first round match yesterday, winning a tough one over Frenchman Lucas Pouille. The 14th-seeded Anderson is confident about his ability to advance deep into the tournament, saying that top seeds are not going to have it easy in the early rounds, as the field this year is particularly talented. It's still early, but the most prestigious tournament in tennis has gotten off to a great start. I'm Jonah Haskell.
And I'm Toddy Abedje.
And that's the sunny side of sports.
And that's the sunny side of sports.
Back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Toddy and Jonah. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, the life of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, also known as AGOA,
gets an extension. And in Cameroon, thousands of young girls continue to be forced into a life of servitude and sexual abuse as child brides. First, here's Rapture Kids of Sierra Leone with Attitudinal Change.
better one. Change your attitude and behavior. This not to politics circle. So you win a doctor. Put the patient in life first before money. Teacher and lecturer. Una na no people there.
Rapture kids with attitudinal change. Well, the U.S. Congress is extending the life of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, also known as AGOA, for another 10 years. The current bill expires in September, but the House and Senate passed similar versions of the bill. If President Barack Obama signs it, both chambers of Congress will create a final bill. Mariama Diallo reports on the future of the AGOA program.
The trade provision that allows thousands of products from African countries to enter the U.S. tax-free was approved by the House of Representatives in a 397-32 vote.
The motion is adopted without objection.
Fred Oladende is the chairman of the U.S.-based AGOA Civil Society Organization Network.
I think it allows all of the stakeholders to see AGOA as a vehicle for long-term economic development.
Oladende says to use AGOA as a tool for development, African countries have to look beyond the energy, apparel, and textile sectors. A regional approach for other primary products like mangoes, for example, is a must.
So a lot of mangoes out of Mali, but couldn't come in because of the stringent sanitary and phytosanitary requirements. We want to meet those requirements, but even when we have met those requirements, we also want to see how we could take those mangoes, add value to it, where we can can them, where we can pasteurize them.
The African Diplomatic Corps in Washington strongly supports renewal, but Senegalese Ambassador to the U.S., Babacar Diagne, says more changes are needed to get the full benefit of AGOA.
I must say I'm still a little bit frustrated. You know what? About 39 eligible countries, just 7 or 8 are taking profit from AGOA. So we have to fight for the renewal, of course, but we also have to put a special focus on training business people in our countries to, let's say, make them meet the criteria required to profit from AGOA.
Ivory Coast has been in and out of AGOA, exporting cocoa, coffee, cashews, and textile apparel to the U.S. Its ambassador, Dauda Jabate, says he hopes the renewal will expand exports to the U.S.
To be frank, we want our trade capacity to be increased because, you know, everybody is saying, oh, AGOA, but most of the time, some country cannot make a huge exploitation of this opportunity that has been given to them.
Florizel Lizer, the U.S. Assistant Trade Representative for Africa, recently said AGOA has had successes but can do more.
There's been a tripling of non-oil exports to the United States. It's created a lot of jobs. We've seen investment go into Africa. But at the same time, if you look at how much came into the United States in non-oil exports last year, it's like $4.9 billion. That's it, from all of sub-Saharan Africa.
She said the hope is that in the next decade, AGOA will be used to its full potential so that it can help Africa maximize development. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Traditional culture, grinding poverty, and the lack of official concern has forced thousands of young girls into a life of servitude and sexual abuse as child brides. Community leaders along Cameroon's border with Nigeria support the practice of parents getting financial loans by giving young daughters away even before they are born. Critics call it one of the country's worst forms of child and gender-based abuse, a crime that has gone unpunished for too long. Eugene Nfongwa traveled to a small town in West Cameroon where the practice is common.
It's Makadei Nakoya, a small administrative enclave on Cameroon's western border with Nigeria. Hundreds of people have come from surrounding villages to sell farm produce. Most are women, and some have trekked for 2 to 3 days to be here. Lucy Opoff runs a tailoring workshop not far from the market. It is a crammed room with 3 sewing machines. There is also an ironing table. One wall is lined with finished blouses, another with posters of models and flare gowns. Like many of the ladies at the market, Opoff is unlike most 21st century women. She's what locals here call money woman. In clearer terms, she's one who was married off while she was still trying to repay family debts.
Now my uncle be go chop money for...
Opoff says her uncle used her as collateral for a loan when she was still in her mother's womb. After she was born, she was then taken to the man who passed her over to a relative. She says she was only 5.
They're around 5 years.
Giving away girls to settle family debts is widespread in this part of Cameroon. Campaigners for its abolition say it affects more than half the women in over 20 towns and villages. Town hall officials in Akwa say lack of jobs and a weak agricultural sector on which the people depend are fueling the practice. Martin Equella is the town's mayor.
It's also true that it's due to the hardship, poverty in the area, that is making parents to either give their children as a mortgage or also to say maybe we have one or two other problems to solve. The child is used as a shorty.
Community leaders defend the practice. They say using girls to settle debts is a legitimate path to marriage, and it comes with some advantages to the woman. Simon Ajua is the deputy chairman of the Akwaye Traditional Council, a political and religious body that makes and enforces such rules.
Money woman, now woman where, if you marry her.
He says the children of money women have a right to control and inherit their father's property. If the child is a boy, he also has the right to give away girls into marriage. Money women can in turn marry off their girls and use the money to marry more women into their husband's family.
For the woman, it must be where he did take them, get them for married, then he get for continue with the family.
But victims and critics paint a different picture that often includes extortion and blackmail. Women have no say in how they're treated, and their conditions worsen when they become widows. According to the account of more than a dozen people familiar with the practice, victims of early marriage end up in years of servitude and sexual exploitation. They're withdrawn from school because their new families fear they will become smart and aware and try to escape. Gloria Ambushi was not yet born in 1982 when her family took a loan to keep an uncle out of jail. When she turned 12, she was sent up to marry a 70-year-old man in his dying bed. 4 months later, she was a widow and willed to the man's son, a 40-year-old who already had another wife. She says she was mistreated, beaten, and made to work on the films every day, including on Sundays. When it became unbearable, she says she escaped, but her mother sent her back. Ambush says her mother feared one of them would be killed if she ran off again. Ibrahim Sidhu is the second most powerful government official in the area. He has been on duty for only 2 months, but already knows how this type of early marriage affects women.
The problem of marriage précoce de la jeune fille de notre localité est un problème.
He says it is a sad and serious problem that touches many people since the entire lives of girls are sacrificed. However, he adds, the administration has not been able to do anything beyond educating parents and perpetrators.
C'est une situation grave. À notre niveau, on essaie de sensibiliser.
Early and forced marriage is not peculiar to Akwaya. An estimated 1 in 3 women throughout Cameroon is believed to be a victim. Impoverished communities in the north and east of the country are the worst affected, with up to 7 in 10 women marrying before 18. But using women as collateral for debts and other favors is not the norm in Cameroon. It has been reported only in this mountainous patch of forested territory of more than 80,000 inhabitants. The Olitis, a tribe of mostly peasant farmers, are among the most prominent. They share the same core beliefs and practices with about 100 other landlocked ethnic groups. Community leader Ojua says the practice started in the area around the end of the Second World War.
Because of poverty, and sometimes you get
poor families with nothing else began marrying off their girls to earn money in the form of bride prizes.
If you go give me a woman picking, I will give you money.
The practice took root and has been kept in place by powerful traditional councils and shrines led mostly by men. Bad roads and little contact with the outside have concealed the abuses from the rest of the country for 3/4 of a century. International organizations and NGOs that usually tackle similar issues are not yet on the ground. The Catholic Church began repaying debts to free some girls, but quickly ran out of resources and left. With no government protection or assistance, victims are on their own against powerful traditional institutions that are reluctant to change. A few have started to speak up, but the town's mayor says it would take many different types of interventions to tackle the poverty considered to be at the root of the problem. Reporting for VOA Africa, I am Eugene Fongwa in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In a further sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of the Middle East and Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on four key leaders of the terrorist group ISIL, or Daesh. With roots in a 1990 jihadi group, ISIL has dramatically undermined stability in Iraq, Syria, and the broader Middle East, posing a threat to international peace and security. It has recruited thousands from across the globe to fight in Iraq and Syria, committing gross, systematic human rights abuses, including mass executions, persecution of individuals and entire communities on their identity, killing and maiming children, rape, and other atrocities. ISIL claims to be the true heir of Osama bin Laden's terrorist legacy. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information on Abd al-Rahman Mustafa al-Qaduli, up to $5 million each for information on Abu Mohammed al-Adnani and Tarkan Teuma Razovich Batirishvili, and up to $3 million for information on Tariq bin al-Tahar bin al-Fali al-Awani al-Harzi. Al-Qaduli is a senior ISIL official who, when released from prison in 2012, traveled to Syria to join an ISIL network. As a member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or AQI, he served as its leader Abu Masab al-Zakari's deputy and as its emir in Mosul, Iraq. Al-Adnani, whose birth name is Taha Sobi Falaha, is a senior ISIL leader and its official spokesman, the main conduit for disseminating ISIL messages. He has repeatedly called for attacks against Westerners and has vowed defeat for the United States. Batirishvili has served as a senior ISIL commander and Shura Council member. He has overseen an ISIL prison facility in Al-Tabqa, where ISIL possibly held foreign hostages, has worked closely with ISIL's financial section, and has managed ISIL operations in the Manbij area of Syria. Al-Harzi was one of the first terrorists to join ISIL and has served as an ISIL official operating in Syria. He has helped to raise funds from Gulf-based donors and was recruited and facilitated the travel of ISIL fighters. He was named its leader for the border region between Syria and Turkey. He also has served as chief of ISIL's suicide bombers. The United States guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have such information, contact the nearest U.S. Embassy or consulate, the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net, or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.